When was the last time that you did good badly? When did you do good badly? Do you know what I mean by that? Maybe you thought you were doing good. You approached the need, the task, with the best of intentions, but the person that you were helping didn't appreciate it. Or maybe you ended up hurting somebody's feelings in the process. Or maybe you found at the end of it all that you didn't meet the actual need that was there. You did good, but you did it badly. Or maybe in hindsight you look back and you realize that what you did was good, the deed was good, but you did it for the wrong reasons. Rather than it being about the other person and their need, you in hindsight would say, well, you know, that was really more about me. It was about making me feel good. It was about making others look at me a certain way. It's about what I got out of it. Sometimes doing good is not as straightforward as it seems, is it? If you were part of the last series that we did on the parable of the Good Samaritan, you may have come away from that series with that perspective, that sometimes doing good is not as simple, not as clear-cut as we think it is. Sometimes it can be very complicated. And so this morning we start a new series, really flows out of the last one on the Good Samaritan, called Doing Good Well. Because we can do good, and we can make lots of attempts to do good, but doing good does not automatically mean that we're going to do it well. How do we approach the important task of doing good and doing it well? Because there are all kinds of ways that it can go bad. It can go bad in how the person that we're doing the good deed for receives it, but it can also go bad for the one who's doing the good deed. Peter Greer, who's an author and a nonprofit executive, wrote a fascinating book with the title, The Spiritual Dangers of Doing Good. He says this in that book. He says, I have seen friends and mentors throw themselves into the causes of justice and do extraordinary work for Jesus. I admired their passion, their devotion, and their sacrifice. But despite their extraordinary dedication, things went wrong. Burnout, infidelity, lost faith, financial compromise, personal meltdowns. My heart goes out to these friends and the ministries they worked so hard to build. Sometimes doing good doesn't go so well. And at least one factor that I would suggest to you in why that can be the case is because of why we're doing what we're doing. Sometimes the why, when it comes to doing good, is really not good. And so I'd suggest to you this morning that the why should come before the what. Why is it that we're doing the things that we're doing? Why are we doing the good deeds that we're doing? We need to look at that and think about that and start there before we talk about what is it that we're doing? How are we doing the good deed? And today's issue really comes down to those situations where we might find that what we're doing is less about the need and less even about the deed that we're doing for someone else and more about what others think about us as we do good. You know, that can drive us more than we might realize. Sometimes we are motivated to do good, especially because we want other people to think better of us as we do. We want them to look at us in a certain way. We want them to see us as a kind person, a generous person, a compassionate person, a humble person, a smart person. Sometimes we're motivated by how others see us to do the good we do. We all face that in some way or another. I face that. You know, big part of my role week to week is standing up here and bringing sermons to you. And I want you to like those sermons. Now, my job kind of depends in some ways on you liking my sermons. And yet, sometimes I feel compelled, sometimes I feel God leading me to say something that might be hard to hear, that might be sensitive. And so I struggle. Whatever I've said, I think about it afterwards and I wonder, was I clear about that? Did that make sense? Was that confusing? Did I just like muddy the waters for everybody? Was it interesting? Were people engaged? Were people nodding off as I talked? You know, is it sacrilegious to use a rubber chicken prop when I'm speaking? Or to quote Taylor Swift, you know, am I allowed to do those things? These are the things that I think about. And just a little trivia note. When I was early in pastoral ministry, because of my concern about what people would think of me as I spoke, I would always have Kim read my sermons ahead of time and give me feedback. And then it got to the place a couple years in where she's like, this is kind of boring, like me reading the words and then having to hear you present them later, so I don't want to do this anymore. So we stopped doing that. And so, you know, any blame for what I say is purely my own. Just, you know, put that out there. You know, I face that. People who teach face that same kind of thing. People who lead music. We're concerned about what people think of us. Now, that is not all bad. I mean, it is good to want to do the best job that we can possibly do. It's good to get feedback from other people and to give and receive affirmation and encouragement. Those things are all good. The issue comes when we dwell on what other people think of us. When we go beyond just wondering or asking what other people think to obsessing and rehashing. And so this morning, if we're going to talk about ways to do good well, let's first mention a couple ways that we can do good badly. And one of those ways that we can do good badly has to do with managing the impressions of others. You know, trying to control what other people think of us as we do good. A number of years back, I had a high school class reunion coming up. And I'd thought about it and ultimately came to the conclusion that I was not going to go to this reunion. And so a close friend from high school that I was still in touch with emailed me and was kind of trying to change my mind about going. And so I emailed him back and I didn't ultimately give in, decided not to go still. But I told him, you know, while you're there, if anyone asks about me, you know, you can tell them that, I mean, in the last couple decades, I've gone on to hone my formidable intellect, to sharpen my sense of humor, to accomplish impressive vocational feats, and you can also tell them that I'm much better looking, but only if someone asks. Now, I meant that to be funny, but there was a grain of truth there. Why is it that I still care what people from a few decades ago think of me? Why do you care so much what people think of you? Why is it that it's so important to us that we control the way other people see us? Why do we want to make sure that people think about us in the way we want them to think about us? Well, that tendency within us also affects the way we do good. And in fact, if we're driven by managing people's impressions, we will do good badly. But it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop with just managing impressions. We could actually get to the place where we are doing good, and what it's actually doing is feeding an approval addiction. It's another way of doing good badly. Feeding an approval addiction. In other words, living in bondage to what other people think of us. Needing their approval. Now, here's a few test thoughts that might help you to evaluate if you might be in danger of an approval addiction. If you're often hurt by what others say about you, if you often compare yourself to others, if you find yourself getting competitive in ordinary situations, if you're envious of other people's success, or if you feel like you don't measure up to the accomplishments of other people, if you find yourself showing off to make a good impression, even stretching the truth to impress someone, if those things are true of you, any of those things are true of you, then maybe you're at risk for an approval addiction. And there are a couple problems with an approval addiction, with a focus on managing other people's impressions of you. One problem is that when we are dwelling on what others think of us, you know what we're doing is we're actually focused on ourselves. Do you know that? When you're dwelling on what others think, you're actually focusing on yourself because you're thinking, how did I do? How was my performance? I have to do a good job so that people see me the way that I want them to see me. A lot of I and me there. It's really less based on what others think of us and more based on what we think they think of us, right? Because they may not say anything about us. Someone once wrote these words. I think they were trying to be funny. They said, when you're in your 20s, you live to please other people. When you're in your 30s, you get tired of trying to please others, so you get miffed with them for making you worry about it. And when you're in your 40s, you realize nobody was thinking about you anyway. Now, I'm, you know, approaching the back half of my 40s, and I think that last one just might be true. I am increasingly convinced that people think about me a whole lot less than I think they do. Maybe the same is true for you. And of those that do think about me, some probably think that I'm better than I really am. And some probably think that I'm worse than I really am. Either way, dwelling on what others think is really having more to do with me than it is with them. That's one problem of dwelling on what others think. Another one, and probably the bigger problem, is that when we are dwelling on what others think of us, it becomes very hard for us to remember what God thinks of us. If we're so focused on what others think, it's hard to remember what God thinks. And the writers of the scriptures lay it out for us so clearly in so many places, what God thinks of us. For God so loved the world. Loved the world that he gave his one and only son. John records those words of Jesus. And the Apostle Paul, he learned from the best because he agreed, even before he made the world, God loved us and chose us in Christ to be holy and without fault in his eyes. God decided in advance to adopt us into his own family by bringing us to himself through Jesus Christ. This is what he wanted to do. He didn't do it begrudgingly. It gave him great pleasure. And even beyond making us family, Peter goes on and he highlights, you know, you people of God, you are a chosen people. You're a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. So you've heard from John recording Jesus' words. We've heard from Paul. We've heard from Peter. And Luke also records this tender statement from Jesus. After Jesus has talked about not worrying, he says, "Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom." I love to read about what God is pleased to do. He loves us. He's adopted us into his family. He sees us as a chosen people, a royal priesthood. as his little flock that he wants to give the kingdom to. Not that we have to earn it, he wants to give it to us. When we're dwelling on what other people think, it's awfully hard to remember things like this. So what will set us up to do good for the right reasons? If why comes before what, then what's going to set us up to do good well? Well, let me offer you three suggestions. The first one is this: decide whose opinion of you matters. Decide whose opinion of you really matters. Psychiatrist David Burns has done some research into these kinds of subjects, and he's discovered that it is really not a person's compliment or another person's approval that makes you feel good about yourself. It's not the compliment, it's not the approval. That's not what it is that makes you feel good. What it is it's your belief that their opinion is valid. That's what makes the difference. And to make the point, he offers this kind of mental exercise. Imagine that you go to the behavioral health unit at the local hospital. And you walk in, and a patient there greets you. And this person says, "I had a vision from God, and he told me that the 13th person to walk through the door would be his special messenger. And you are that 13th person. So you are the chosen one. You are the holy one. You are the bringer of peace to the world. Let me kiss your shoe." Now, if somebody in the behavioral health unit of the hospital said that to you, wouldn't that just bolster your self-esteem magnificently? Well, Burns says, of course not. Because of the validity or not that you assign to that person's opinion. Because of the weight that you give it. Other people's opinions of us are powerless unless we grant that opinion status and credibility. You know, this is why people can accomplish extraordinary things and still feel like a failure. Consider this person's life assessment. "I have done nothing. I have no ability to do anything that will live in the memory of mankind. My life has been spent in vain and idle aspirations and in ceaseless, rejected prayers that something should be the result of my existence beneficial to my own species." Those words were written near the end of his life by John Quincy Adams, who was an ambassador, a congressman, a secretary of state, and president of the United States. And his assessment of his life looking back was, "I've basically accomplished nothing." Now contrast that approach to the approach that Paul offers to us, particularly in 1 Corinthians 4. And I want to take you there, and I'd invite you to turn there in your Bible with me to see what Paul says. So Paul is writing this letter, 1 Corinthians. It's his first letter to the church in the first century city of Corinth. And as we dive into the midst of this letter, Paul has been writing about various pastors who have ministered to this church. So he is one of them. A guy by the name of Apollos is another one. And Paul has caught wind. He's moved on from Corinth, but he's caught wind that the people of Corinth are kind of like playing their pick your favorite pastor game. You know, some like a Paul better, some like Apollos better. It's, you know, a dangerous game for pastors who dwell on what other people think. There was once a pastor who was leaving a church, and at the farewell reception, he saw a woman weeping. And he said to her, "Don't be sad. I'm sure the next pastor will be much better than me." And she said through her tears, "That's what they said the last time, but they keep getting worse." comparing pastors can be a difficult thing for the pastor. So, chapter 3, Paul's talking about him and Apollos. We come to chapter 4, and he says this, beginning verse 1. He says, This then is how you ought to regard us. By us, he's meaning him and Apollos, as servants of Christ and as those entrusted with the mysteries God has revealed. Now, it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. I care very little if I am judged by you or by any human court. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me. Therefore, judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait until the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of the heart. At that time, each will receive their praise from God. There are several things that are striking to me about those verses. Paul says he cares very little what other people think of him and how they judge him. Can you imagine caring very little about the criticism or judgment that comes from others? What would it be like to be liberated from the need to impress anyone else? What would it be like if your self-esteem was not reliant on other people noticing how successful or smart or attractive you are? Can you imagine the ability to feel love for a person who disapproves of you? Well, Paul seems to have gotten to that place where he could say, Corinthians, I love you, but it doesn't matter to me what you think of me. And what's more, from this text, what's even more fascinating is that Paul says, it doesn't even matter what I think of me at the end of the day. It doesn't matter what I think of my own performance. And it's not because he saw himself as perfect. It's not because, he thought he was all that. I mean, he said his conscience is clear, but that in and of itself doesn't necessarily prove that he is right. I mean, Paul knew that he had issues. I mean, in another letter, he calls himself the worst of all sinners. He knows that he has his problems. He's not ignoring them, but what he's saying is those issues don't define him. Those issues won't stop him from pursuing the work and calling that God has for him. And ultimately, he says, there's only one evaluation, only one opinion of me that really matters, and that is God's. Are you willing to make the same decision, and it is a decision that Paul made, as to whose opinion of you is going to be the most valid, whose opinion is going to be given the most weight? We need to make that decision about who it is that we're going to listen to. We can choose who we give weight to. No opinion holds sway over us unless we allow it to. And Paul says there's only one opinion that counts, and it's not even yours. Decide who you're going to listen to. And secondly, remember whose you are. Remember whose you are. Theologian and priest Henry Nouwen says this. He says, at issue here is the question, to whom do I belong, to God or the world? Many of my daily preoccupations suggest that I belong more to the world than to God. A little criticism makes me angry. A little rejection makes me depressed. A little praise raises my spirits, and a little success excites me. Often I am like a small boat on the ocean, completely at the mercy of its waves. Well, if you want to steady the boat, try remembering whose you are. Remember that you belong to the one who has loved you since before creation, the one who has welcomed you, if you will come, into his family. The one who has called you to be holy, to be set apart, to live differently. He's called you to that and wants to empower and enable you to do it. Remember whose you are. You are sons and daughters. You are saints of God. It's his pleasure to give his little flock the kingdom. Can you dwell more on what God thinks of you and wants for you? Can you tune out other voices and opinions and evaluations? Because none of it matters nearly so much as what God thinks and has said about you. And let me offer you one more suggestion, and this is kind of like the boots on the ground practical one, because, I mean, remembering, like, that gets a little abstract. But here's a very practical thing for you to do. Practice doing good in secret. Now, I've talked about this before as kind of a spiritual discipline or habit, but you know, it's actually a strategy that Jesus suggests in his Sermon on the Mount. He talks about the value of doing good things in secret. And in Matthew chapter 6, he talks about this, and I'm not going to take you there. It'd be a great text for you to read later. Jesus starts out by saying, "Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven," Jesus says. And then he goes on and he gives three examples of things that we might do to try to make others think a certain way of us. He talks about giving, he talks about praying, and he talks about fasting. And he says, if you do those things and your main goal is to cause all those other people who see you doing them and know that you're doing them to think a certain way about you, to praise you, if that's why you're doing them, then their praise is the only reward you're going to get. But he goes on, and three times he says, if you do these things in secret so that it's between you and God, then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And I suspect that one of the rewards that we get when we do those things in secret is that we begin to dwell less on other people's opinions of us, and we may begin to pay closer attention to God's opinion of us. So if you're looking for a way to make this tangible, go out and be stealthy this week. Be a secret agent. Doing good anonymously for others. Pray intentionally. Pray repeatedly for someone. But don't tell them or anyone else that you're doing it. Give to a person. Give to a cause. But do it anonymously. Be creative. Pay attention to situations that arise. You know, your neighbor goes away on a trip and it snows. Shovel their snow for them. In the springtime, mow their grass for them when they're away. I mean, be creative. What could you do? Where could you be the unsung hero? Church fathers of centuries past had a saying. They connected the idea of secrecy with a heart that was warm toward God. What they said is that if you want to keep the fire hot, don't open the door to the oven too often. Keep what's going on in there a secret to keep the fire going. There are many ways to do good badly. But there are also lots of ways to do good beautifully, wonderfully, well. In ways that are self-forgetful in a helpful way, but are focused on Jesus. May we live out of this place of confidence as God's loved children. Would you pray with me? I pray, God, that you would forgive us for that self-focused bent in each one of us. That self-orientation that Jesus came and lived and died to kill so that we could be raised to a new life with him, in relationship with you, living with confidence as your child. Oh Lord, may that identity be impressed upon us, and may we live out of that identity. Out of that identity where you are much, where you are great, where you are magnified, and we are appropriately small and yet deeply loved. Work in our hearts in that kind of a way, Lord, that we might be free of dwelling on what others think of us because of how much you think of us. Holy Father, Lord Jesus Christ, Spirit of the living God, in your name I pray these things. Amen.